Now stay tuned for the Sunday morning wake-up call on 94.7 WPVC-LP Charlottesville. The wake-up call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Now here's your host, Rick Moore.
I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore, who is taking a well-deserved day off. The Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA is celebrating its 10th anniversary in its beautiful setting on Berkmar Drive in Albemarle County. Earlier this week, I paid a visit to the shelter to catch up on the many programs and services it offers. In the background, you may even hear some of the shelter's canine guests. Jackie Bright has been the executive director of the shelter since February 2016. Ryan Willis is the animal care manager for the shelter. I began by asking our guests to talk a little bit about themselves. So, Jackie, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, so my background has been in nonprofits ever since college. Most recently was the executive director of Big Brothers Big Sisters. And I came to the SPCA because of my personal love of animals. I felt as though it was a real alignment between my personal passion and my profession. So what a lot of people don't know is I grew up on a little ranch in Montana, and we rescued wild mustangs and dogs and cats and birds. So I grew up with a real understanding of the importance of taking care of animals in need. And so, again, when this opportunity presented itself, I jumped at the chance to be a part of this great mission.
And Ryan, how about you?
So I've been with the SPCA for a little over 5 years now, and like Jackie, animals have always been a passion of mine. And, you know, I wanted to work here because I think the services that we provide and the care that we provide for the animals is truly just a noble cause that I enjoy and that I'm passionate about.
Okay. Now, there is an impressive list of services on your website. Jackie, can you talk about some of the services that you provide at your facility?
I think you just hit it on the head. It is very impressive. We have so many programs that we're offering to the community. It's been just wonderful for me to get to know all of them. You know, some of them include our summer camps. For example, we're in the middle of providing summer camps to children in the community. And those camps are a phenomenal way for kids to learn about animals, how to care for animals, how to have respect and compassion for animals in a really fun setting. There's a lot of crafts and activities and things of that nature. We also offer an art camp for children from at-risk communities, which is another great way to expose children to, you know, compassion for animals, animal well-being. And in that particular camp, we focus on an art project that is here at the shelter. Again, just another wonderful way for us to educate the community on the importance of animals and the role they play in our lives.
And we also provide a lot of great services to the underserved in our community as well. So we have compassionate care clinics a few times a year, which will allow people to come to our facility, and we're able to give their pet basic care that they may not be able to otherwise receive at a traditional veterinary hospital. We also provide throughout the week different walk-in clinics for microchipping, rabies vaccinations. We really try to make ourselves accessible to the community so that everyone can ensure that their pet is being as well cared for as possible.
Now, it is the thick of the summer as we're recording this. Can you talk a little bit about the summer camps?
Sure. Well, you know, it's funny because right now I have a broken foot, and so I have to park actually where the campers are having fun outside, and so I get to see them playing and, you know, throwing the basketball and all those kinds of things, and I'm wishing I could get out there and join them. But, you know, I think, again, the camps are just it's a really great way to introduce the shelter to children and families. I think sometimes for a lot of people, you know, they don't have an awareness of the shelter. They might not ever come, or they might not know what we provide, the services we provide. And so this is a great way for us to help the community. We can help families in need. I know the summertime can be a challenge for a lot of parents who are looking for activities for their children. And so this is a great way for us to help those families. We give them, you know, a real quality experience. And then again, we're also providing really, really beneficial education to hopefully start, you know, developing our new foster families and our new adopters. There are our adopters up and coming.
Now, it's not just dogs and cats either, is it?
Well, it's not just dogs and cats. I think that was my big surprise when I started working here. We have also some very small animals. Now, we're not providing services for livestock or wildlife, but we do have other small pets such as, you know, hamsters or gerbils, or I have seen the occasional turtle around here too. But yes, we do. And bunnies. There have been some bunnies. I've seen a few bunnies in some of the offices too, as we're providing some foster services. Our staff have been given some bunny love.
So this is the 10th anniversary in your current building. Can you talk a little bit about the building and the land surrounding it?
Sure. So, you know, our organization has evolved tremendously in the past century. It was founded in 1914 by a group of animal lovers who were essentially caring for dogs in their homes. And then in the 1950s, the organization moved into a retrofitted chicken coop. And today it's in our specially designed facility that, you know, we have now. Our facility boasts an adoption clinic and a center for the animals. It was completed in 2004, and it's located on Berkmar Drive. We're open 7 days a week. We sit on 9 acres, and we have wooded dog walking paths. We have spaces designed to give our staff and volunteers the environment they need to help, you know, thousands of animals that move through our facility every year. The structure offers separate suites for cats. We have an air filtration system designed to lower disease transmission among animals. And we have a humane education room that, you know, again, touching on the camps, that we use to teach youngsters about the importance for caring for animals.
And what's the size of your staff here?
You know, we have approximately 60 staff, and that includes the rummage store. And nearly all of our staff are providing direct services to animals, either through the clinic or through animal care. You know, it's a very hands-on facility. We have a great team.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC. My guests this morning are local SPCA Executive Director Jackie Bright and Ryan Willis, who is the Animal Care Manager at the facility. Okay, so the shelter is designated as a no-kill shelter. What exactly does that mean?
So that means we are providing care for animals that can be safely rehomed, both behaviorally and medically. So it's a real milestone that we have achieved now, being 10 years as no-kill. And so when we became no-kill in 2006, it was heralded as the largest community since the San Francisco SPCA to achieve this status by the esteemed animal welfare group Best Friends Animal Society. However, to reach this milestone required years of hard work and collaboration. Staff and leadership had to put in place key initiatives to increase spay-neuter procedures, to reduce the number of animals brought to the shelter, expand the shelter's foster network, and raise funding to build a new facility. So after all of that work, today we have reached a 95% live release rate over the last 3 years, which is fantastic. The gold standard is 90%, so we are exceeding that standard, and we're very proud of that. But it's also it's helped expand our role in implementing innovative strategies, such as our most recent effort to purchase a mobile unit to help underserved in our region to get needed pet care, keeping pets with their families, and reducing the overall pet homelessness in our region.
And are no-kill shelters the exception to the rule? Is this fairly unique facility, or are there other no-kill shelters in nearby counties?
Overall, nationwide, it is the exception to the rule. There are other no-kill facilities in Virginia and in the region. However, ours is pretty unique in that we also work with the local city and county as well.
I'm guessing it takes a fair bit of money to keep the shelter going. Jackie, what can you tell us about how the shelter is funded?
You're right. As with any, you know, amazing mission, it does take resources to execute, and we do require support, or rather we benefit greatly from support from our community to make our mission possible. So essentially 60% of our revenue comes from donations and public support, and we also receive grants through various foundations, and we have a contract with the city and county to provide pound services. So what that means is we are essentially a hybrid organization where we are providing the required pound services to the community of the city of Charlottesville and the community of Albemarle. And in addition, we are providing basically for-profit independent sheltering services. So, but overall, we do definitely benefit greatly from the support of our community. It's the majority of our budget, and we are very grateful for everyone's support.
And speaking of funding, I understand you have a new rummage shop. What can you tell us about that?
Well, so it's yes and no. It's new. It's in a new location, but it's actually been in existence for quite some time. It started out with, I guess it was annual sales, one time or two time sales during the year. And it's developed into an actual store. And it is located in the Seminole Square Shopping Center. And the rummage store is another very important part of our funding stream. It brings in anywhere from $200,000 to $500,000 annually, which is a huge, huge support system for us. And essentially, we accept donations from the community, and then we sell those contributions or those donations back to individuals who are looking for a great bargain and looking for some really unique finds. And I'll tell you, since we've moved, we've gotten in an incredible amount of really, really neat things, really unique things, too. And so I highly recommend folks to go check it out if they haven't been. It's great.
All right, so what's an example of some of those really unique things that we might find in the rummage shop to get us excited about going over there?
Well, we did have a really, really gorgeous car about a week ago. It was a BMW that was donated in great condition. And we also get everything from jewelry to dresses, and we've had coach purses. We have some furniture, books. I mean, yeah, you name it. It's there.
And where is the rummage shop?
It's located in the Seminole Square Shopping Center at 199 Zan Road, which was previously the Downtown Athletic Building.
And Jackie, does all the proceeds from the rummage shop come eventually get to the shelter?
It does, 100%. And we also have a few cats in the facility as well. So for folks who are interested in adopting animals, you can pick up a few great finds, and you can pick up a new family member as well.
All right. You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC. My guest this morning is local SPCA Executive Director Jackie Bright and Company. I'm Dan Gould, sitting in for Rick Moore. Okay, Compassionate Care a Van. What is it?
I'm going to have you say that three times fast. Well, so first, before we get into what the Compassionate Caravan is, I just want to thank the Perry Foundation, who is making this possible. They awarded us a challenge grant, which will essentially provide us with the funds that we need to execute this incredible initiative. And really, basically, what it was, it came about because we see great need in some of our underserved communities for compassionate care for their animals. And we recognize that there are barriers for some folks in securing that care, whether it's financial barrier or in some cases it's just basic transportation. As many of my friends in the listening community know, the transportation for underserved communities is a real challenge, and it's a real barrier for people to take advantage of a lot of the great services we have. So that's really where the idea came from, and it is literally a van, and the intent is for us to drive the van to communities in need, and we will have, you know, our qualified clinic personnel inside the van, and it'll be stocked with supplies, and they'll be able to provide a great deal of care to animals in some of these communities. And we also see this as an opportunity to expand adoption so that we can take animals and really showcase all the wonderful cats and dogs we have and hopefully find some homes for them. So the clinic, this compassionate caravan will, when it's all said and done, we need to raise $73,000 to match the grant, and we are over halfway there, which is really exciting. And that's really our hope for today, is that if there's anyone who has an interest in helping support this initiative, we would greatly appreciate, you know, talking with you a little bit more and seeing if it might align with folks' philanthropic needs.
And Ryan.
Yes. So to kind of expand upon what Jackie has said and to, you know, reinforce the importance of the van, it's really going to just help keep animals with their families. So this will impact low-income families, rural families, seniors, or disabled individuals who just can't get their pets to shelter for basic care. So this unit will be able to go essentially to the underserved, and will certainly, hopefully, increase our outreach throughout the region. So as Jackie mentioned, it will be used as a mobile clinic to provide veterinary care, in addition to increasing awareness throughout the community. And then, again, it can be used for adoptions as well at various offsite locations, which is also great in that we're able to have that much better of a presence in the community. And in addition, it will also help transport animals back to our clinic, who may require slightly more invasive procedures that only a true veterinary clinic could provide, such as spay, neuter. But the nice thing is, for those individuals who wouldn't be able to come to us, this is what that van will be able to provide.
And where does the idea come from for this project? Is this a local initiative, or has it been done elsewhere? Can someone talk to that?
Well, I know it was something that a variety of different staff, I think, kind of all thinking on their own, but having the same thought, wanted to be able to do here with this SPCA and for our community. It is a feature of many other SPCAs throughout the nation, honestly, and they proved to be very effective in providing the best care possible for the community.
And you talked a little bit about this before, but I just wanted to expand on this. You talked about outreach to people who may not have transportation to bring their pets in and so on. Is there a system of discounting the costs based on need?
There is. And so what we are doing right now is establishing that infrastructure, but essentially it would be individuals who are on public assistance or who could otherwise demonstrate need. And it'll be, as you said, likely a tiered system based on need. And in some cases, you know, if the need is severe, we would hopefully be able to provide scholarships or some type of support.
So will the van have a route and stops like a bookmobile would have? Or will you just go where the need is?
I'm picturing a bat signal in the community. Maybe a cat signal. You know, we haven't entirely determined that yet. What I'm envisioning is that we will, over the course of the next several months, be developing relationships with the communities in need and identifying certain locations. For example, community centers where we might set up regular times, regular hours. Certainly, if there was an emergency need, you know, we would of course do what we could to accommodate that. But my sense is that we'll be establishing, you know, sort of set times and days with some of the key leaders in some of these areas.
Do you see the van as a means to bring care to situations where, say, there's been a fire or there's been some other natural disaster that has displaced a lot of animals and animals are in need of care in that situation?
You know, I think that is another example of how useful the van could be. I think, yes, in those situations, with the support of local animal control and other local first responders. And I think it would be fantastic for us to also have a presence in those situations so that people know that we're there for their pets and them as well.
You've talked about the initial cost of setting up the program. Will the shelter also need additional ongoing funding for staff to manage the program?
Absolutely. I think, as with many nonprofits, you know, your program is only as strong as your staff and your staff capacity. And as we are looking to expand our outreach, it will require more staff support, especially our trained clinic professionals. So yes, you know, that is that's part of this this initiative. And as it continues to grow and expand, we do anticipate that there will be continued financial needs to support it. And we envision that it will be very successful and very beneficial. So our hope is that as we can showcase the need and the success of the program, that we will continue to find supporters.
And what geographic area will the program serve?
Well, it'll certainly serve Albemarle County and the city of Charlottesville, as we are their primary provider for care for this area's animals.
And I'd like to talk a little bit more about funding, because I guess that's a big issue right now to get this program off the ground. You've talked a little bit about matching funds. Do you have some special ideas or particular ideas for how you're going to raise your part of the matching funds?
Well, I was hoping that you'd be kind enough to write us a check there, Dan. you know, we have been doing a lot of outreach already. We have been working with a lot of our current donors. As Ryan shared, you know, this is an initiative that has been very successful in other communities. So people who are familiar with animal welfare, you know, are really excited about this. They see the value and the benefit, and they're very eager to get behind it. So we've been working closer with our current donor base, and we've also, again, been reaching out to people who we know have an interest in animal welfare and talking more about this program to try to gain their support. So I guess the strategy has really been individualized. We're really trying to work with people one-on-one, share how this program is going to impact the community, and work with them to gain their support.
And do you have a target date? A date by which you hope to launch?
Well, so our hope is to get everything completed fundraising-wise by the end of the year, with a target launch of January of next year. So folks can reach out to us via our website, www.caspca.org, and through our website they can find additional contact information for our team. But really, if people do have an interest in supporting us, they can we will make it as easy as possible.
All right, that's good to hear. Now, the van itself, is this going to be a custom designed vehicle that you will have commissioned to do this?
Yes. So I can't tell you exactly who the manufacturer is, but there are those manufacturers that custom build and retrofit existing vehicles that are out there. So we will definitely be contracting out to get a state-of-the-art compassionate caravan.
And so what staff members will travel with the van? Will there be a vet on board at all times, or how will that work?
Well, I would think it would depend on the situation that and what the van is going to be doing that day, who's going to be, you know, what services it was going to be providing. Certainly, if there's going to be veterinary care, then we will certainly have our vet, maybe our vet tech, and some clinic staff there as well. But we may also have adoption counselors there. We could also have other humane educators as well, I would foresee. So there's going to be a variety of staff. I think anybody who shows interest and, you know, has a knowledge and then can help those who would use it.
And will the services provided by the van, will there be a subset of the clinical services that are available here? You won't be able to do everything in the van. Is that right?
That's correct. So it's going to be exactly that, a subset of the care that we're providing here, with the added option of being able to transport animals in need back to the clinic for more advanced care.
Now joining the program is Sarah Silverstone. She is a volunteer with the site, with the shelter rather, and Samantha Davis, who works with the shelter, and she is the volunteer coordinator. Good morning, ladies.
Good morning. Thank you for having us.
Good morning.
All right, so I thought in this segment we would talk a bit about volunteering and some other odds and ends things, so maybe we'll start with Sarah. You must need a whole lot of volunteers to operate the shelter. What can you tell us about volunteering at the shelter?
Yes, there are hundreds of volunteers who help out here in a variety of capacities. Myself, I'm a cat socializer, so I come in and I work with the cats, especially with the ones who are scared or not yet socialized, in order to help them become attached to people so they can have a better chance of being adopted. We also have a huge team of dog walkers who come in and take the mini dogs out for walks during the day, which is really beneficial for the animals to help them get out of their, you know, enclosures and get exercise, and it also helps them become better socialized as well. There are volunteers who come in and help with landscaping. There's a great crew called the Flora and Furries Garden Club, headed up by Cindy Scott. And they really maintain the dog trails and all of the landscaping you see outside the shelter. So there's a huge task force of volunteers who come in.
Now, Samantha, you're the volunteer coordinator with the shelter. What can you tell us about the kinds of volunteers? You have adults, you have young people.
I'm glad that you asked, because we have a very wide spectrum of volunteers, not just in terms of their age, but folks that do have full-time jobs, other volunteers that are retired and are able to give us a bit more of their time every week. A lot of our cat socializers, for example, are here multiple days for hours, so they get to know the animals really well. We also have a junior volunteer program, which are for kids aged 14 to 17. So because they're not 18, they're not handling the animals on their own. They're helping the staff out with mostly light cleaning duties, organizational projects, and it's really great for them to get involved. We actually have some folks that volunteer as, you know, high school students, and then I know Linda Batten, who works with us, started out as a junior volunteer years and years ago. So it's a great program, and a lot of kids do use it to fulfill their community service hours for school as well.
Now, the fostering program, is that a part of the volunteering program at the shelter?
It is, because fosters are volunteers, but that is not something that's under my purview. That is under our clinic, actually, and is headed by a team of three ladies that get the animals out into foster, intake them when they come back from foster, and keep up with all of the things that they need while they're out of the building. So our foster program is huge, especially in the summer months when everyone has heard of kitten season, when we have a large influx of kittens, mama cats coming in with litters. So we really rely on our fosters to get those guys out of the building for socialization until they're old enough and healthy enough to go up for adoption.
And what can you tell us about the number of volunteers that you have in each sort of group, adults, young people?
It's a bit of a tough question, because, as I said, we have some volunteers that are very regular and are here on a weekly basis. Other volunteers are only able to help out with, you know, off-site events maybe once a month, but there's a fit for everybody. We have probably a solid 100 volunteers that are regular and are here every week. On a Saturday, for example, we have anywhere from 30 to 40 volunteers come in to help out with the various things around the building that we need. We're currently recruiting for help over at our rummage store, which we have that new facility over in the Seminole Square Shopping Center. So we're looking to get a good core of volunteers started over there to help out with receiving and sorting and all the different aspects of the rummage store. We do have cats available for adoption over there as well, so that's important to know.
Now, Sarah, you're a volunteer. What pulled you into the shelter?
I have always loved animals. My dream as a little kid was to grow up to be a vet and, you know, care for animals. And then I discovered that I couldn't really handle being in the room with my cats when they got shots. So the vet career was off the table. But I moved to Charlottesville almost 2 years ago, and I started volunteering here around a year ago. I'm a freelance tutor, so I have a pretty flexible schedule. And I was looking for, you know, some place to volunteer and get involved in community service. And combining my love of animals, this was perfect. So I come in and I work both with the cats and with the public. So when people come in looking to adopt an animal, a big part of that experience is finding the right fit. You know, what is your home like? What are you looking for? What type of animal is going to be the best fit? Do you know, do you want a dog that's really playful or a dog that's, you know, snuggly and chill? Do you want a cat who's going to be a lap cat or a more independent cat? Do you have small children in the home? You know, you want to make sure there's an animal that's going to be a good fit. So it's really great helping people come in and find their new companion animal.
And how many hours a week do you log at the shelter?
Oh, gosh. I would say it depends on the week. It could be anywhere from 6 to 15 hours a week. That's probably my average.
Now, lots of volunteers, that means lots of people need to be trained. What can you tell us about how you get your volunteers trained? Samantha?
We are actually working to improve our training process for new volunteers. Over the last 2 months, we have been working to get some new dog walkers trained. So that's a multi-step process so that we can really tailor the training to the individual volunteer, meet them where they're at, see where their comfort level is, and provide them with whatever training they might need. There is a minimal requirement for all volunteers, but for a task like dog walking, that's something that takes a particular skill set and a certain amount of physical ability. So there is a screening process involved. Training is ongoing, just like it is for the staff here at the shelter, because there are constantly new animals coming through. As an open admission shelter, our population changes from one day to the other. So keeping up with that is no small feat. So our adult volunteers start off with a general orientation. These generally happen twice a month. We do have one more adult orientation this month on Saturday the 16th. That's at 11 o'clock a.m., and that's open to anyone who wants to come, is interested in volunteering, wants to learn out more. We do want to get our new volunteers in positions that will be the most helpful to the shelter. So at general orientation, we will discuss the available volunteer jobs that we have at the moment and how to start the training process for things like dog walking or volunteering at the rummage store. Junior volunteers have an orientation once a month. They come in the first Saturday, so we have a new team of junior volunteers that get started usually every month. And as I said, the training's really ongoing, but it really is going to depend on the volunteer. Sarah, as a new volunteer, came in with previous experience volunteering at a different shelter, a lot of knowledge of shelter cats in particular, and their behavior and personalities in the shelter setting. So she didn't need as much training as a volunteer who might come in and say, I've actually never been around cats before. I'm starting from scratch. And we have to make sure that folks are safe when they're here volunteering. Working around animals is definitely unpredictable in a lot of ways. So training is something that's really important to us to make sure that our animals are safe and our volunteers and staff are safe as well.
And what's the venue for the training? Is it like a classroom setting? And how many people would be in a typical class?
The general orientation involves a tour and then a bit of a classroom setting where we come upstairs and sit down as a group, go over what we talked about on the tour and cover that basic information and what volunteer jobs are available at the moment. So it's definitely a mixture of both. It is for the junior volunteers as well, hands-on training as well as classroom setting. So again, we can meet each volunteer where they're at and get them the information in multiple ways so that they retain it better.
And is there a fee for the training classes?
Not at the moment. There is not. We do provide volunteers with a volunteer t-shirt, so we do ask for an orientation fee for that. But that is something that does not happen at general orientation. That is an informational session. If you come, you do not have to bring the orientation fee with you. That is something that will be handled once you've been assigned to a volunteer position.
And if listeners want to find out when the upcoming classes are, how would they do that?
Please visit our fabulous website, caspca.org. There is a volunteer tab, and you'd want to select adult or junior volunteer for information on the next upcoming orientations.
Now, you have so many interesting programs here, and one that comes to mind is the Seniors for Seniors program. How does that work? Ryan?
So our Senior for Senior program is fantastic because it incentivizes folks to adopt senior pets who may inadvertently be overlooked for those who are younger and in our care. So the Senior for Senior program has a couple of stipulations. The animal, if it is a cat, must be at least 12 years old, and if it is a dog, 8 years old, and the adopter must be at least 60 years old. But the adoption is free after that, and as well as we will be able to provide basic veterinary care on a continual basis. So it's really a great program. We have to see a lot of successful results from it.
So the care you offer, is that for the full natural life of the pet?
Yes, it is. It is for the natural life of the pet.
Earlier we talked very briefly about the microchipping program. What is the microchipping program and how does that work, Sarah?
Yes, well, every animal that comes into the shelter receives a variety of veterinary services, their vaccinations, they're spayed, they're neutered, but I think one of the most important things is the microchip. That microchip will last for the pet's lifetime. It's a small, very minuscule device embedded under the skin, and it has a unique ID number affiliated with it. So if that pet ever gets lost, any vet or shelter can simply scan the microchip and call up the name and phone number associated with that microchip. And that tool has helped many pets get reunited with their families. It's also a useful tool for when animals come into the shelter. If they're an animal that was previously adopted from here, we automatically know who that animal is and have all their veterinary records.
And is the microchipping system universal? So if a cat, say, hitched a ride in a pickup truck and ended up in another state, would they be able to get that animal back here?
Yes. Any microchip scanner will pick up all the different microchips from different corporations. Doesn't matter what brand or what state.
Now, you microchip every animal that comes through the shelter, as you said. Do you also provide microchipping service for members of the public on a fee basis?
We do offer public walk-in hours for rabies vaccinations as well as microchipping. So this is a service is offered not just to residents of Charlottesville or Albemarle County. Anybody can come on a Thursday, Friday, or Saturday. There's an hour or two in the afternoon where our veterinarians are on standby to provide the rabies vaccination and a microchip. You can get both of those services for $30, and that does include a lifetime registration for the microchip, which is a really important part. We do see stray animals come into us that might be microchipped, and then we get excited and come to find out the chip has never been registered. Without that registration, the microchip does us no good whatsoever. So for both our adopters and for public members of the public that are coming in to get a rabies or a microchip, we take care of that registration at that time so that it's taken care of for the life of the pet, and then the owner is able to go online at any time and update the registration. So that's a really helpful part of the process.
So when animal control brings in a stray, I assume you immediately start looking for a microchip. Does it happen very often that you can reunite an owner with their pet through that microchipping program?
That is a great statistics question that I do not have the number for. The really cool thing about a microchip is that it's permanent identification. A collar with a tag on it, especially when it comes to cats, come off very easily. The collars that cat owners should be using are breakaway so that the cat can't choke themselves. So collars go missing, tags go missing, but the microchip is permanent identification, and it really does give the pet the most likely chance of being reunited with their owners. So if they come in with a microchip, even if it's not registered, there's some stuff we can do behind the scenes to try to track down where the microchip was implanted or who sold the microchip. But that registration is really key to reuniting the pets with their owners. As I said, when pets are adopted from here, we know that it's registered because we take care of that. So we have had pets that inadvertently come back to us that have been adopted from us, and we know right away who they belong to, as Sarah mentioned, because the microchip is in our personal system as well as in that national database.
Looking toward the future, what are some of the long-term plans for the shelter? Jackie?
Well, you know, this is such a great question, especially right now, because we are in the process of developing a strategic plan. So there's a lot of great conversation about what is our future direction. And I can guarantee that we will always be here providing services to the city and the county. One of the things that we are really excited about exploring is more of our outward expansion efforts, like the caravan, for example, you know, really being able to take our programming out to the greater community to reach more people in need. But generally, overall, I think our goal is really to try to focus on preventative measures, you know, really making sure that we can provide support to ensure that animals are able to stay in their homes.
Ryan?
So I know that we had touched upon foster care earlier in the program, but I think it's important to put it in perspective for folks so you can really understand the need that we have for foster parents. We currently have a little over, if you can imagine, 200 kittens in foster care right now. But it kind of goes along, you know, with the height of kitten season. But again, it's a lot of kittens, but like I said, they're currently in care. So that is a testament to the folks in our community who have stepped up to the plate and are really, you know, literally opening up their homes to these animals that need care. But we will always need more fosters. So if you, you know, have a little extra time, and often, you know, summer provides that for families or individual folks, you know, we can set you up with as few as one kitten or as many as a litter of six or seven, and even sometimes they'll have nursing mothers as well. It's really whatever your comfort level is and your experience. But if kittens aren't really quite your alley, sometimes I know people are allergic to cats. We also still have a need for their foster opportunities for dog lovers as well. And that includes puppies. We do normally have an increase in our puppy population this time of year. Doesn't always quite match the kitten population. But even still, if you have an interest in fostering an adult animal, we are more than happy to, you know, have you take that animal into your home and give that animal a break from the shelter here. Because while we provide a high level of care, the shelter will never, you know, replace a home environment. So not only will you be allowing that adult animal the opportunity to catch their breath, so to speak, and be even more relaxed in a home, you're also going to be able to then give us information about your experience with that animal in the home. You know, are they a couch potato? Do they like to chase squirrels? How, you know, well house trained are they? Do they know any other types of basic skills that a lot of people are looking for when they're adopting an animal? And then you can relay that information to us, which really, really ups their adoptability, which is just fantastic information. So if you have the time and the space to help with our fostering, we will gladly invite you into the facility and get you oriented with what's required and what you can do. And we're just happy for all the help that we can get. It helps our staff. It helps the animals. It's really just a win-win. If you want to get more information about our foster program, you can everything that you'll need will be on our website, which is, again, www.caspca.org. And there's an online application, so we can get a lot of that initial paperwork out of the way so that when you come to our foster orientation, we can get the wheels turning sooner rather than later. And hopefully you can go home with an animal that day.
Ryan, is there a particular demographic that goes with the kind of people that foster? Are they younger? Are they older? Retired? Is there a particular niche for fostering that you found through your experience?
It's been my experience that people of all walks of lives come through our doors for almost every service that we provide, but certainly fostering. There are families with kids who are always super excited, particularly with the kittens and the puppies. But there are single individuals, there are young couples, there are older folks as well who have, you know, a tremendous amount of animal experience throughout their life. So, you know, really, there's no one specific group that fosters more than another. There might be certain ones that prefer certain fostering situations.
And do you provide orientation services for would-be fosterers, training of any kind?
Yes, we do. So we have regular foster orientations where we have an experienced staff member explain what it means to foster with our organization in terms of different fostering options, what we will provide for the animal so that people don't feel like they need to be obligated to provide veterinary care, for example, who to contact and how to contact if an emergency situation is to arise. The time range for fostering can also vary. It mainly depends on the need of the animal. If it is a young kitten or puppy, it will usually be in foster care until they are healthy enough and of weight for spay or neuter surgery, and then they'll come back, have that procedure done, and go up for adoption. If it is an adult animal, we typically ask at least 2 weeks for dogs, slightly longer for cats. Cats can sometimes take a little bit longer to adjust to a new environment. But again, it just depends on the need. In certain cases, if we have a foster with a particular set of skills and training, we may even have them assist us with some basic behavioral cases as well.
Does fostering ever lead to adoption?
Oh, yes, and we're okay with that. Foster failures, as it's typically called. So, yes, you know, there's sometimes people, they will foster this animal, and they'll say, I'm not going to keep this animal. I'm just here to help for as much as I can. And then it turns out they're the newest family member, and we're absolutely fine with that, and it's great to see.
You're listening to the Sunday Morning Wake-Up Call on 94.7 WPVC Charlottesville. Now, we've been talking about fostering, but there are also a great many adoption success stories. Can you tell us about the story of Bo?
Absolutely. He's one of our most favorite animals that's been in our care, certainly since I've been here. He kind of had an interesting story. I'll be honest, he wasn't one of those in our care, into a home, quick situations. Thankfully, there are many of those that occur, but not all the time. Bo came into our care 2.5 years ago, originally, at the beginning of January 2014. And he was brought to us as a stray, as the vast majority of the dogs and cats and other small critters are. But he has a slightly unique story. He was essentially a community dog. Some would label him feral. I wouldn't exactly go that far. But he didn't have a true home either. He was living in one of the more rural areas of Albemarle County. And for about 9 or 10 years had been just roaming around in a specific area and being cared for by various community members. But nobody had really claimed them as his own, or as their own, excuse me. And that is not it's not a common thing to occur here, but it is not unheard of either. But he was relatively socialized, but by no means would I think anyone here suggest he was your average companion dog. He certainly would come to those whom he had gained trust with, who would feed him regularly. He may even have allowed some of those community members to pet him. But he wasn't about to be a lap dog right off the bat, you know, which is okay. I think it's important for people to understand that each dog is an individual and cat, and that they may not always conform to our ideal standard of their personality immediately or ever. And honestly, that's okay. They should be allowed to be who they are. So Bo came into our care, and
we, you know, immediately recognized that he was a dog that was going to require some patience and understanding, which, you know, which is one of the reasons why we're here, and we're happy to accommodate his needs. He clearly was used to living outside. We would keep him in one of our enclosures, which do have indoor-outdoor access, and he, you know, preferred to be outside, you know, enclosed and covered, but being inside was not really his favorite thing. So we started to work with him. We basically came to the understanding that no one was going to claim ownership of him, that no one was going to, you know, take on the responsibility of truly caring for him in a traditional ownership sense. So after his stray hole period, we assessed his medical needs. He had a couple of he had a little bit of an odd thing going on with his tail. And he may have sustained an injury when he was out roaming for all those years, and it healed a little awkwardly. But our vets were able to help him and correct that situation. And you know, we also knew from a behavior stance that it would be unwise to try and cuddle up to him right away. That would be, he was clearly a little fearful, and that would make him uncomfortable, and we wouldn't want to do anything to put him in a bad position, or to, you know, potentially injure someone, though he never showed any aggressive behavior. So he was in our care for a while, and we had the opportunity to get to know him a little bit better, though it took some time. He, though, rapidly became, as I think I mentioned earlier, a staff and volunteer favorite. And there were a few staff members and a few volunteers that, you know, took extra time to really work with him and try to get to know him, not push him, but just try to understand who he is and try to make him understand that he's in a safe place, that everyone who surrounds him here means well, and that we really only have his best interests at heart. So we were going along, and he was here for a few months, and somebody came who was interested in adopting him, and we were very excited because, you know, I think in the back of our minds we thought he might be in our care for a while. So, you know, we said, you know, we got to take a shot. We got to find reasons to say yes to adoption and not no. So he found his first home. Unfortunately, it didn't work out. So they returned him to us. But as unfortunate as that may sound, and of course we would have loved for it to have worked, it did provide us as a learning opportunity. We got a little more insight into Beau. He continued to stay in our care, and he was actually adopted a couple more times later in 2014, but again, it just wasn't quite the right fit. But we weren't going to give up on him. We knew this may take some time, but the right person, the right situation is out there for him. We just have to have a little faith and just, you know, learn more about him and just find that right home. So a few more months passed, and a few more months passed, and he was adopted again, actually, by someone who knew him pretty well. But again, it unfortunately just did not turn out to be the best fit. So after that adoption, when he was returned to our care, he actually stayed with us for a year straight and didn't leave the facility. And one might think that would make him a little stir crazy, and to be honest, it can for some of the dogs. But Beau acclimated very well. He became very comfortable here, and while that's all good in some ways, we still wanted him to find that home. So how
long had he in the story? How long has he been with the shelter at this point?
At this point, he has been in the shelter in and out of the shelter for over a year. And then he's entering, this is about February of 2015. So he's about to enter the longest span of his continual span of time here in our care. And all the while, again, we're learning more about him. And we got to a point where he didn't want to walk on a leash. Understandable. He probably never had or anything like that. But towards the end of his stay with us, we were able to walk him on a leash, get a collar on him, pet him, groom him, brush him, and he seemed to actually really enjoy that. So he really came a long way, and it was it's all to the credit of the wonderful volunteers and staff that worked with him. Finally, you know, the sky parted, and somebody came interested in adopting him, and they seemed to have the right situation for him after all we had learned. They would be consistently at home because he had a bit of separation anxiety and would sometimes like to wander off. They had another dog, which we didn't quite know how he would react, but it is proven that this dog has been a great companion for him and I think has helped him a lot. And they live more in a farm setting. Now, we don't traditionally advocate all of our dogs to roam freely on a farm per se, though he obviously has access to come inside and has an enclosure, but it just seemed to make sense and it seemed to work for him, and it has worked for him. So despite, you know, 2 years, a little over 2 years of being in our care, and some people thinking, when is he ever going to get a home? Is he ever going to get a home? He did. And that's just one of the great success stories here at the SPCA that proves, you know, just a little bit of effort and patience goes a long way. And wrap it up real quick. I know we're running out of time, but his adopter has now gives us monthly updates on him with pictures and little synopses, and it's fantastic. So it's an SPCA success story. We couldn't be happier.
That's a great story, Ryan. Jackie, any last thoughts before we go?
Well, you know, it's funny. I'm laughing because I am a foster failure. I've been with the organization for just a couple of months, but I already have adopted another cat, and I'm probably on the way to adopting another puppy that we're fostering. So I can feel the pain of my foster failure family friends out there.
It's a good pain.
It is a good. That's exactly right. You know, I can't reiterate enough that there is so many ways for people to connect to this organization to fulfill, you know, their desires to volunteer or to provide financial support. Whether it's the rummage store or the facility itself or providing support to our animal care team, there really is just a spectrum of ways that people can connect. And, you know, we will do whatever we can to find a way to plug you in a meaningful way. So please reach out. Visit our website, caspca.org. You can really get a better sense of all the programs that we offer, although we've touched on quite a few today. And you can also find contact information to connect yourself to any of those programs of interest.
And it is an amazing website, too. There is so much information there on really all the things we've talked about. In fact, they could pretty much eliminate the need for me altogether because really everything we've talked about is covered there to some degree. Just before we go, let's have that website address one more time.
Absolutely. So it's www.caspca.org. Once again, that's caspca.org.
My guest this morning has been Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA Executive Director Jackie Bright, and joining us during the program was Ryan Willis, who is the Animal Care Manager, Sarah Silverstone, who is a volunteer, and Samantha Davis, who is the Volunteer Coordinator. Jackie, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you.
My interview with Charlottesville Albemarle SPCA Executive Director Jackie Bright, her staff, and volunteers was recorded on location at the SPCA shelter on Berkmar Drive on July 5th, 2016. You can listen to this and every episode of The Wake Up Call at SeavillePodcast.com. Rick Moore returns next Sunday at 11 a.m. Coming up at noon, El Club del Sabor. For the Sunday morning Wake Up Call, I'm Dan Gould. Thanks for listening.
This has been the Sunday Morning Wake Up Call on 94.7, the progressive voice of Charlottesville. The Wake Up Call is brought to you by Tiger Fuel and the markets of Tiger Fuel. Production assistance and engineering from Sean McCord and Mike Friend. Be sure to join Rick next Sunday morning at 11 a.m. for the Wake Up Call, only on WPVC LP Charlottesville.